All right. Welcome to the second court. If you weren't here to hear the introductions when we came in for our 10:30 arguments, the panel today for your case consists of, to my left, visiting Justice Michael Massengale up from Houston. We're happy to have him. To my right, Justice Wade Bodwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand that you've checked in with the clerk, and everybody has notified our clerk what times and who's going to argue and in what order. So with that, I'd ask that the clerk call the case.
The court will now call Stephen Johnson versus Shirley Jacobson, Tarrant Appraisal Review Board and Tarrant Appraisal District. And may it please the court, Mr. Gray Pearson to argue for the appellant, and Ms. Julia Armstrong to argue first for 15 minutes for Tarrant Appraisal Review Board, and Ms. Catherine Alder to argue second for 10 minutes for Tarrant Appraisal District.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pearson, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Various governmental entities, such as municipalities and school districts, of course, get their revenues from property taxes. Property taxes are based on the values of properties. Those values are determined by appraisal districts. If a property owner feels that his or her its property has been overvalued, the property owner has the right to appeal that or protest it to an appraisal review board, which has a protest hearing. Many times the property owner will feel that the owner is not sufficiently sophisticated to do that by himself. So the owner will engage a professional licensed property tax consultant to do that for him. These people, for our purposes, are referred to as agents. Now, among other things, the law provides that an owner may only have one agent at a time. The appointment process is very strictly defined by statute. That is section 1.111 of the property tax code. The appointment process is very specific. There's nothing for the review board to do except receive the form. The form, in fact, may be, by statute, handed in at the hearing. Now, sometimes an owner will engage a corporate entity as its agent. Now, corporate entities may only act through human beings. Unfortunately, and this is where the problem started, certain individuals at the review board became confused. Here we have the one agent law, only one agent at a time. So when some people appointed corporations or corporate entities as their agents, the corporations in turn selected or appointed individuals to appear on their behalf at the hearing. Certain individuals at the review board thought that, well, the owner has appointed the corporation. The corporation appointed this person, therefore this person is a second agent. That is a basic misunderstanding of corporate law. The second person is not, or the person appointed by the corporation is not a second agent or a sub-agent. That person actually represents and is the corporation or the corporate entity. Nonetheless,
how does the board know that?
Pardon me?
How does the board affirm that, confirm that? Is it solely just based, I am, based upon the representation of the person who is purporting to represent?
Yes.
So there's no evidentiary burden, and the board has no discretion whatsoever with regard. The board must simply accept the representation of whoever shows up at a hearing that they are, in fact, the representation. They are affiliated or sufficiently affiliated or designated or anything with regard to the party, the entity, or individual who's actually identified on the FID, and the board's supposed to take that.
They are, and I'll point this out.
What's the authority? What authority do you have for that?
Because they must accept the filed representation that's turned in at the hearing. Let me point this out. Justice Birdwell.
But that specifically in the statute says that you're, the individual or the person is, may file their FID at the time of the hearing.
Right.
Okay, well, that's an FID. That's in writing.
Right.
Okay.
And then it's turned in, or it is filed, and someone shows up. Let's say it's filed beforehand, the person shows up. But there has never been, so what you're talking about is possibly of an imposter showing up, an imposter agent.
No, I'm talking about somebody who shows up and just says, I'm here on behalf of tax consulting firm A, who filed the petition.
Yes.
Filed the application with the petition and identified themselves with the proper FID, and I've been hired by them to come represent them.
And that being not true?
How is a board supposed to determine whether that's true or not?
It has never been untrue to this date. During discovery in this matter, the representatives that we deposed were unable to cite one single example of where that has ever occurred. Not one.
Your pleading says that this profession of people representing property owners for these tax protests, it is independently regulated, monitored. Are there any regulations about who is permitted, authorized to appear for these purposes? For example, does somebody have to be a lawyer to represent somebody else in these proceedings? Or are there any other types of regulations like that?
There are. It is very tightly regulated by the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulations. And here's the rule on that. Now, someone could hire a company, and that company could send its janitor, provided that there's no compensation. But if there's compensation, then they must be licensed, or it's a violation of the law. The key is compensation.
Okay, and do those regulations speak to this practice that seems to be in controversy here of, property owner appoints some entity as its agent, and then that entity has to send a human being. The human being could be an employee, but to the extent it might not be an employee, but is instead, I would think for one thing, it wouldn't seem controversial if the person sent was a lawyer who represented the corporate entity that was the agent. Is there any regulation that speaks to what other kind of individual person is permitted to appear to represent the corporate entity that's acting as the agent?
They must be a licensed professional tax consultant. The entity could not hire someone who's not licensed. That would be against the law. That's very tightly regulated.
And do the regulations speak to the kind of relationship that has to exist between the entity and the individual?
No, none at all. But it's somewhat akin to this. Let's say a law firm here in Fort Worth has a case pending in El Paso, and it engages a local El Paso lawyer to cover a routine hearing. And that lawyer were to show up, and the judge would say, well, now, excuse me, are you a member of that firm? The lawyer says, well, no. Well, okay, case dismissed. That wouldn't happen, because that would be absurd. But the person turned up, and they were not a licensed attorney, that would be a whole different matter. They have to be licensed, but it's very tightly regulated by PDLR, and it's a common practice. So, continuing. Anyway, as a result of this, believing it to be some sort of sneaky, nefarious process, the TARB, or TARB chair, created policies designed to put a stop to it. Well, the policies, in fact, created a problem.
Why do you say that TARB thought it was a sneaky and nefarious process?
Because in the policies themselves, they state it's potentially illegal, and I've included copies of them, of questionable legality, and put various restrictions there that were clearly not appropriate, saying that the first policy said it had to be an officer or an employee. Well, if you had like an LLC, they would not necessarily have an officer. And the person that might come would be a member, if it wouldn't be an employee or an officer. The policies themselves created the problem. Now, subsequently, defendants suggested that the policies might be meant to protect from a situation where someone showed up pretending to be an agent who wasn't really authorized. But as I've discussed, that's never happened.
Well, the fact that it's never happened doesn't mean it can't happen.
Well,
the question is, what discretion does the taxing authority have to determine whether or not somebody who is purporting to represent somebody does in fact have the authority for that representation? If there is in fact a representation made before the board or before in the hearing, whether that representation has the authority of the client behind them.
I don't believe they have any more than they have the authority or discretion to question the signature of the owner.
Trial courts can, district courts can make that determination. If there's some reason, something that comes up during the context of a hearing, there's a specific rule in the rule of civil procedure that says that the trial court can investigate whether or not the attorney representing or purporting to represent actually has authority to do so. So why does not a board, in the process of potentially making decisions that are in fact negotiated decisions quite often, why do they not have the authority to simply request proof that the person with whom they are in fact negotiating has the authority to negotiate on behalf of the person or the entity that they're purporting to represent?
Well, again, I would point out that problem has never once come up in all.
I mean, even the statute itself says the owner can designate, but the lessee, if it's a situation where there's a lessee on the property, the lessee can actually be designated by the owner.
Yes.
But if the lessee designates someone to represent the lessee still has to go through the process of doing a written.
Well, I'm not sure that you can have the lessee designate, according to that particular statute. I think the owner can designate a lessee, but I don't think the lessee can continue the designation. We'd have to look at the statute.
Well, the point is that the statute clearly requires written authority for representation.
That is correct.
And there's nothing whatsoever about the rules that you're complaining about that requires anything other than written proof of designation. It actually expands it to the point where it doesn't have to be an FID, it can be a letter of authority, and in fact the board grants a possibility of a reconsideration if in fact there was a dismissal in error based upon the absence of evidence of authority. And all they're requiring is when you come before us, you show us what your authority is to represent who you purport to represent. And if you don't have that in writing, which is required by the statute, then we'll dismiss your case. But if we do that and there was a missing designation or something of that nature, if you come back and tell us about it, then we'll reconsider it and set a hearing again. So where is that an abuse of, where does that go beyond the authority granted by the statute?
Well, again, I think that all is required is just to file it. I think that you can carry that out to the extreme and say, well, they can check licensing, verify licensing, verify the person is a legal adult again and again and again. But I don't really think the statute contemplates all that authority. I think that it contemplates they'll file it and it'll be accepted. And that's that.
Okay. Where anywhere in the record has that type of requirement been made of Mr. Dunson? In other words, where has he actually had the rule that he's complaining about applied to him with regard to the declaration that you're seeking?
Well, it's in the pleadings repeatedly where this has happened, where he has been actually in one situation where he showed up, they actually had the document on file. It had been misplaced, and the finding was, well, that they found that there was a non-appearance, despite the fact that it was already on file because they'd lost it.
Is there anything in the record to indicate whether or not he sought a reconsideration based upon?
Yes.
Okay. Was there a reconsideration?
No.
Or did they refuse? They refused to hear it at that point in time.
No, it was still pending.
And why? So it hasn't. So there's a motion. There's an outstanding motion for reconsideration of that particular issue.
No. That matter, it was refused to do anything with it. They refused to even bring it back up. It's in the pleadings.
But then why isn't his client before us complaining about this specific issue as opposed to him complaining about it?
Well, again, because it's multiple situations, and it applies to the agents. These agent policies were directed towards the agents. And, again, I believe he has standing. I've brought it up as the Hager versus Ryan case in other cases because he asked specifically, has it impacted him? Yes, it has, repeatedly, on an ongoing basis. We can't deal with the past. We have to deal with the future for this purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Ms. Armstrong?
May it please the court. I expected that I would be spending most of my time here discussing jurisdictional issues rather than the merits of the case. I would like to make some comments about what Mr. Pearson has said. Just to clarify a few things, I think it's pretty clear that the panel has already expended some effort to understand the pleadings and the briefing, but I would like to say that the Appraisal Review Board is the entity that actually promulgated these disputed policies, not the chair. The chair drafted them, but the Appraisal Review Board met and approved them.
And is the ARB a creature of the appraisal district?
No, it is not. That used to be a problem of some concern, but the recent amendments to the code have made it clear that the Appraisal Review Board is a separate agency, and furthermore, that's why you see two of us here today. The Appraisal Review Board must have its own attorney and cannot be represented by the same attorney as the district.
Okay, but you're representing both the ARB and the individual defendant.
Yes, I am, and Ms. Alder is representing the district. I would also like to point out that there are administrative remedies that could have been sought at the time that Mr. Pearson refers to when he believes that his clients were wrongly kept from having a hearing because their FID wasn't accepted. There are at least two ways that this could have been done, but they both are remedies that are available to the property owner and not to the agent. The first one is to do what's called a four-day letter. If you, within 4 days of having been no-showed, you request a reinstatement of the hearing and show good cause, which is submitted to the board. This is an opportunity for you to have yourself reset. If, in fact, the board denies that, you can take it up to the district court under Chapter 42. The other one would be to file an action under 4145F, which is a direct suit against the Appraisal Review Board to compel the board to hold a hearing. And, again, that could be tried in front of the district court. Those are perfectly adequate remedies. In fact,
that's a property owner's remedy, right?
That's right, and that's one of the issues here. The issue of standing has to do with whether or not Mr. Dunson can assert solely on his own, without joining any property owners at all, a remedy that the legislature has made it clear is a property owner's remedy.
Okay, so what's wrong with the theory of pleading that Mr. Dunson is an individual who engages in this business of representing people who are challenging their property taxes? And he does that as agents of, as an agent of various corporate entities that have been retained by the property owners for that purpose. And his contention is that these rules have been promulgated in violation of state law. They are impacting his livelihood. He is challenging the actions of an individual employee as ultra vires actions in violation of state law and outside her authority as a government official, and has filed a declaratory judgment action to seek a declaration of his rights with respect to those practices. That's the question, right?
That's a bunch of questions. Let me start with the last one and hope I remember the first one. He's suing solely under the Declaratory Judgments Act. And in order to do that, he's got to show that there's been a waiver of immunity somewhere that allows him to do that. The UDJA by itself only waives immunity for a state agency under one circumstance. That is when there is a challenge made to the validity of a statute or ordinance. These policies are not statutes or ordinances. They're road signs. So that is going to prevent the suit against the board itself. The suit against against the chair, which was originally Mr. Frazier, could only proceed if the pleadings themselves state a proper description of his action ultra vires. Essentially what that means is that he's got to be dealing with something that does not require discretion, but is effectively a ministerial act. The fact that, and now that will not waive immunity for the board, but it will allow the declaration to go forward, except that that's not what Mr. Dunson pleaded. Mr. Dunson has not in any way stated why, in the absence of direct statutory authority on how to solve this particular problem, which I'd like to outline again better in a second, if the statute is silent on the very problem that he has to resolve, which is what do I do when I've got one name on a FID and another person shows up? How do I know that what I'm doing is going to be legitimate? It won't be considered voidable or void because I had the wrong person in front of me. And the statute doesn't tell him how to do that because the statute doesn't contemplate that sort of thing happening. It contemplates the way things work out in Dallam County, where they had all their hearings this year on Tuesday and Thursday of 1 week. And they don't have the issue of agents coming in and saying, well, I'm been authorized by the agent whose name is on the FID, so just take my word for it. Now I'm forgetting.
Isn't there an issue in part with regard to the ability of the board to conduct these hearings when a purported representation of a client, a representative of a client, basically is saying, well, I can't be there because I'm in another hearing someplace else? That requires the ability of the board to actually make a determination of whether or not that's true.
Exactly. And in order to do that in this particular instance here, which the statute doesn't speak to specifically, there's no way that the board can do that without the exercise of discretion. If it does nothing, then it just throws up his hands and says, anybody who can show up is fine with me, then it's basically not performing its duty to see to it that its own decisions are binding on the property owners that they're supposed to bind. It's as though a person were to come in and say, I'm representing so-and-so in court, and I'm going to defend him against this, or prosecute some action against him.
And for example, if a member of the House is hired, an attorney who's a member of the House is hired to come in to represent somebody in court, the courts could still require that they prove that, one, they're a member of the House, and two, that the legislature's in session.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And it would make no sense to take what is essentially an essentially discretionary authority, an act that can only be conducted by the use of discretion, and compel a particular result or no result, which is, I think, what Mr. Dunson is asking us to do. I wanted to go back to the discretionary aspect because that's very important in determining the ultra vires claim against the chair. If you are acting within your discretion, and your discretion allows you to, in fact, compels you to interpret the statute every now and then because you have to fill in some of the blanks that the legislature has left in it, then you can get it wrong without being wrongful. Otherwise, the exception would swallow up the rule. The Supreme Court recently mentioned that in a case, Hall versus, oh gosh,
Craven.
Yeah, right. It said that very thing, that if people make mistakes, and if every single one of them was sufficient to create an ultra vires argument, then that exception would swallow up the rule, and it would also be pretty wrong-headed. That's not the way the world works.
Okay, but you may have very good arguments on the merits. My understanding of what Mr. Dunson's allegation is that he's identified an individual government official. His allegation is that that person is responsible for the promulgation of rules that are in violation of this, what is it, 1.111G, that says that the appraisal district, the appraisal review board, may not require a person to designate an agent to represent the person in a property tax matter other than as provided by this section. Right.
Well,
that's the allegation, right?
Right.
Okay, and so there may be an answer to that on the merits, but why is that not a cognizable claim that can be filed in a district court seeking a declaration about whether the individual government official is acting ultra vires in that respect?
Well, I think that is exactly the question before the court, but Mr. Dunson's pleaded himself out of court by failing to allege something that would constitute an ultra vires action. The bottom line rule that I tend to apply in these situations is, first, you have to have authority. Second, you have to have, that authority has to be discretionary. And third, if you, in the exercise of such authority, you get something wrong, you misinterpret a statute, or you just interpret it differently than somebody else like Mr. Dunson would interpret it, that is not grounds for an ultra vires finding. Because in a situation like the board is in, and like Mr. Frazier was in, he has to use his discretion every day in the afternoon to figure out the solutions to problems like, how do I determine, or may I determine, whether somebody showing up in a panel is really there on the property owner's say-so. He can't do his job. Nobody in that seat can do their job if they don't have the discretion to read, understand, and interpret that statute, and if needed, to pick up the phone and call Armstrong and Armstrong and ask us for our opinion on it. In the
but
course
why is
of
that not just a defense on the merits of the practice, as opposed to, you know, an argument that Mr. Dunson can't even, you know, cross the threshold of the courtroom door to allege that this practice is ultra vires because it is outside of the authority that's bestowed upon these government officials by the tax code?
Well, he hasn't shown how it's outside of their authority, whereas let me direct your attention to another underestimated part of the Section 1.111 of the tax code. Section 1.111 says a property owner may not designate more than one agent to represent the property owner in connection with an item of property. The designation of an agent in connection with an item of property revokes any previous designation of an agent in connection with that item of property. So when Mr. Dunson comes into the courtroom, and it is not alleged that Mr. Dunson is an employee of some other person whose name is on the FID, All that's alleged is that that person whose name is on the FID can appoint Vladimir Putin, if they want to be their agent. But when that happens, they give up the agency they originally had. Now, Mr. Dunson does not work for, first off, let me back up. The allegations of fact that Mr. Pearson alluded to are in a portion of the pleading that was dropped at the very last minute by the third supplemental petition. And so that took away all the claims for relief that were supported by those allegations that, although I think they were merely conclusory, those allegations that Mr. Dunson had in some fashion been harmed by this. So it's important to remember that while those would have been part of the merits of the case, they aren't anymore. In the absence of anything related to personal damage of him, then he's basically in a situation where he's trying to argue to the court and asking for the court to say, once Mr. Betancourt signs a FID, then Mr. Betancourt can let anybody else be his agent.
Is that not legally the case?
It is, but he drops out when it happens. And
what's
my
your authority for that?
That's section 1.111D.
No. If the property owner appoints Mr. Betancourt's firm, Mr. Betancourt's firm has to appear through a human being, right?
Yes.
Okay. And is there some law that says that Mr. Betancourt can only appear through a human being who is an employee or officer of Betancourt and Associates?
I don't think the code speaks to that, and that's
okay,
part of the problem.
So corporate entities act through human agents, and if Mr. Dunson is a licensed person who engages in this for his livelihood, and he has a relationship with Betancourt's firm, and Betancourt needing a person to appear to perform the services that it agreed to provide for the property owner appears through the person of Mr. Dunson, what is the law that precludes that?
There in the code, there isn't any answer to that question.
Okay,
the code does not distinguish between, it doesn't address the question of even whether or not a corporate entity, which is a legal person but not an individual capable of exercising the rights of a licensed property tax consultant, is even properly there. The problem and this is a problem that's common among many appraisal review boards, is that a lot of people do designate a corporate agent. And when they do, the question is, have they then authorized that agent to appoint anyone else?
Is there a legal distinction between the legally appointed entity, which is serving as the property mm-hmm. owner's agent, appearing through the person that it specified under the ordinarily operable laws of agency versus what you just described, which is the agent then transferring its authority to another party to operate as mm-hmm. the agent directly responsible to the property owner?
Well, first off, I don't think that the general law of agency, which I agree would under many circumstances authorize a sub-agent to be appointed, applies where a statute has restricted that authority, and I think you can interpret subsection D as having done that. But I also want to make it clear that Mr. Dunson is not complaining that he didn't comply. His whole point is, and I'm again referring to the things that have been dropped, but I'll just make that caveat, if they were still in the lawsuit. He's not saying, I didn't do what you wanted. He said, I gave you that paper and you lost it. He's not saying, I can't comply. He's not even saying, it's difficult to comply. He's not saying, I won't comply. And as long as he does, what he does is simply in the service of making sure that the overall purpose of this section is that the property owner gets to decide who shows up and talks for them. That's an important right. and that nobody else can say, well, you appointed me, but you're out of the picture now. It's now in my hands. If that were the case, then everybody in the state of Texas who was a licensed property tax agent, and everybody else, because you don't have to be licensed to be an agent under the tax code. You can just be somebody's mother. It happens. But if it would make a fungible pool such that whenever a property owner picks somebody out of that pool, he's authorized everybody else in it. And that seems like an unrealistic interpretation of the statute.
I've taken you over your time.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Clerk, would you add 2 minutes to Mr. Pearson's time in rebuttal if he would like to take it after we hear from Ms. Alder?
We are dealing here with a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction on claims only of ultra-virus against two entities and one official. It is beyond argument that the ultra-virus exception does not deal with matters of discretion. That's not my opinion. That's Heinrich at 372. It only deals with ministerial acts. Justice Birdwell, you ask where in the code is there either, where does the code confer any discretion? It does. Let me deal with the statute itself and why this plaintiff has not made any constitutional or statutory or common law claim that the trial court could have dealt with. They didn't plead it, for one thing. They didn't plead what the specific acts were that violated something. They talk about the policies, the ARB policies for 2015. I would direct you to page 12 of my client's brief, Karen Appraisal District's brief, where we object to the inclusion of long text in quotation marks, in boldface type, that are said both in the third amended petition, which is the live pleading that the trial court acted on, and in the brief to this court, are said to be, those long two blocks of text are said to be from the 2015 agent policies of Terran Appraisal Review Board. They are not in the record. They absolutely are not in any pages of Exhibit 1 to the third amended petition. You can go through it page by page. The brief says go to page 11. Well, the pages are not numbered, but if you count back to the 11th page, depending on, and I'm sorry, I said it was... it's Appendix 2 to the brief. It's, sorry, let me get my notes here because it's just so dense. It is Exhibit A to the third amended petition. You will not find that text anywhere in Exhibit A. It says to go to page 11. The pages are unnumbered. If you count the pages, depending on whether you count the title page, that'll take you to the CR 66 or 67. You will not find that text there. You will not find it anywhere in CR 56 through 67, which is the Exhibit A to the third amended petition.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying.
Yes, sir.
Okay. In the brief that we have for Mr. Dunson.
Yes, sir.
There is an Appendix 2, which is the 2015, which purports to be the 2015 policies with regard to the board, correct?
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to as Exhibit A to the third amended?
Yes, sir.
Is what we have in Appendix 2 identical in substance? It's a copy of what is appended to the third amended.
I personally went to the district court's website, to the third amended petition, to the document, and went page by page.
Okay. Now, that being the case, and I'm looking at Appendix 2, that document.
Yes, sir.
You're right. It's not paginated.
Right.
But there is a page which at the beginning in bold says FIDs and in parentheses appointment of agent for property tax purposes dash form 50-162.
Yes.
That page, I'm looking at that page. It's not numbered, but the beginning of the page appears to deal specifically with the issues that we're being asked to consider, and it rolls over to the next page and goes halfway down to where it reaches another bolded title, postponements. And so what you're telling me is that the pleading, the third amended, the language that he's relying on doesn't appear anywhere from the FID to the postponement of these two pages.
That's what I'm saying, Your
okay.
Honor. It's not in the third amended. It's not. And it's cited again and quoted again in appellant's brief, and it is simply not there.
Okay, tell me specifically what language is not here. What is it that you're saying he says is the complaint that's not here? Because he's complaining about the policy, and you're saying that what he's complaining about is not the policy.
Exactly.
And the pleading itself demonstrates that as a matter of law.
On page 4 of the appellant's brief, after, as part of the first full paragraph, there are two bullet items. These are what I am referring to as the two blocks of text. They are in quotation marks. They are in boldface type. And these two bullet items are specifically what Tarrant Appraisal District contradicted in its opening brief. It's what I'm calling to your attention today. This material that is in quotation marks does not appear anywhere in the attachments to the third amended petition that are on file in the district clerk's office. They do not appear anywhere in the clerk's record in this case. They do not appear anywhere in Appendix B to the appellant's brief. They are the core, the basis of the complaints about the agent policies, but they do not appear in the record. I'm going over my time. I want to please take a moment as quickly as I can to turn your attention to answer your question about where does the code either negate or confer discretion. If you look at section 1.111, and the text is in Appendix 1 to the appellant's brief is the full text, and if you look at paragraph subsection 1.111B, there is a very long first sentence. Following this court's direction in the Riley case, statutory construction is as a matter of law. It's what we're looking at now to see whether there were allegations in the trial court over which that court could exercise jurisdiction. Heinrich tells us that ultra-virus claims do not deal with discretionary matters. Please bear with me just a moment. Looking at subsection B, first of all, it is directed to the person making the designation, not a duty of the appraisal district, the appraisal review board, or Mr. Frazier. Go back up to A. It says a property owner may designate. If they do designate under B, the designation must. There are two things that the designation must do. First, the designation must be made by a written authorization. And then goes on to clarify that. And then, fifth line down, the sentence continues with the second thing that the designation must do. May I continue?
Briefly.
Okay. It says the designation must clearly indicate that the person is authorized to act on behalf of the property owner. That's the duty imposed on the property owner in making the designation. There is not a duty or a negation of a duty on the appraisal district, the appraisal review board, or Mr. Frazier. There is implicitly a grant of discretion to them because of the duty on the property owner to clearly designate, to clearly indicate who is authorized in the scope of the authorization.
So basically you're making an argument that the use of the word clearly grants implied discretion,
yes, sir,
to the authority to make a determination of whether or not the designation is clear or not.
Yes, sir.
And or to permit some form of clarification and to determine how that clarification can be made.
And that's consistent when you move down to subsection K. It says that when the chief appraiser receives a designation, a FID, that has been electronically filed, they shall, the one submitting it, they can request, and the one submitting it has to give them this list of information. It's discretionary.
Would not L also be indication of discretionary because L says that the board can make a determination of whether or not false information has been provided in the designation? That would have to be discretionary in determining whether or not there is an authentic designation.
It's necessarily discretionary.
Okay. Thank you very much, Council.
First off, Ms. Adler is absolutely correct. The cited portions of the 2015 agent policies actually are from an ancillary document, but I don't think that has any relevance for this reason. Those policies, as appellees themselves have argued, were superseded by the 2016 policies. I next want to cover a couple of things. We did not drop the factual allegations, as pointed out in our reply brief. This is based on the trial court's ruling. This is not an issue where we are to determine the factual issues or matters of disputed fact based on the lower court ruling. These are matters of law. The trial court's ruling was that as a matter of law, the pleadings negated jurisdiction. Concerning discretion, we've argued that the TARB chair acted ultra vires in violation of statute. I would contend, you've talked about discretion, Justice Birdwell, and reviewing various documents. First, would point out that with respect to the 2016 policies, there's simply no discretion to delegate the job of reviewing these forms over to TAD, which is exactly what the 2016 policies do. there's supposed to be like a Chinese wall between TAD and TARP that is not to be breached under any circumstances. Instead, the 2016 policy has made it worse by delegating this job over to TAD.
Council, specifically Chapter 1152 of the Occupations Code deals specifically with tax consulting services and who is a tax consultant,
right?
Property tax consultant. Subsection 6 of 001 defines property tax consulting services. It doesn't say anything about those services having the tax consultant having the authority to sub-designate someone else to be the tax service provider.
No, and that's exactly right.
So where are we to find the authority that you are asserting that a designated entity, an LLC or partnership, because person is defined in that chapter to include partnerships, associations, etc., where are we to find anything that allows that entity to designate another agent that is not clearly affiliated with the association or the partnership or the corporation?
They may not designate by transferring the owner's designation. What they may do is employ someone, a licensed tax consultant, to work for them. Then that they may employ a licensed tax consultant to work for them.
Then where is the error? Where's the abuse of discretion? Where's the ultra-virus act in requiring proof of employment, whether it be as an employee or as an independent contractor?
In my opinion, there's just simply no basis for it. There was no problem whatsoever. None whatsoever until these policies were created. There was no problem. Talk about the danger of this happening, that happening. I'll point out, there was no problem with sub-agents, second agents, or imposter agents. There has never been such a problem. The only problem has occurred based on the policies that have caused all sorts of problems. And going back, but again, there's no authority to delegate to TAD. Regarding the bringing in TAD and TARB as necessary parties, the TARB chair has initially designated TARB to enforce the policies and has TAD now doing the discretionary part of trying to determine who can appear and who can't appear. The Declaratory Judgment Act provides that when declaratory relief is sought, all persons who have any interest that would be affected must be made parties. Now, in a similar case out of this court, the Brennan versus Willapark case, let me quote this. This was a case where some taxpayers had been taxed. They paid their taxes. Several years later, it turned out that several entities, governmental entities, had not been included in the tax roll. So they went back and tried to fix it. The taxpayers sued and said, hey, you can't do that. There's no legal authority. They sued the chief appraiser, and they brought in the various entities. One of the entities, the city of Aledo, argued, quote, that it was not required to be joined because the declaratory judgment action was not seeking construction. We're trying to invalidate any Aledo ordinance or franchise, saying, hey, we don't have business being here. You're not after us. This court rejected that, saying, because the DGA permits statutory challenges and governmental entities may be bound by those challenges, the DGA contemplates entities must be joined. Because we have a valid DGA action against the TARB chair, the entities must be joined to their necessary parties. Does the court have any further questions?
No.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Just to thank you all for a very thorough and interesting oral argument. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go.
From the Second District of Texas, now stands adjourned.